While the Supreme Court did weigh in on federal health care subsidies today, we have yet to hear from the court on same-sex marriage. That opinion could come tomorrow or perhaps Monday. At issue is whether states can ban same-sex marriage and whether they can decide not to recognize marriages performed in other states. If the justices rule in favor of same-sex marriage, more couples will have the legal right to marry, but will they actually decide to get married? Research shows that the gaps in marriage rates are widening along racial, socioeconomic lines, and that more Americans are either waiting longer to get married or not getting married at all. So what accounts for the marriage drop-off over the past 50 years, and what does that trend say about the role marriage will play in the next 50 years? On today's program, we will talk about the future of marriage, and we'll start our conversation with Kim Parker. She's Director of Social Trends Research at Pew Research Center, and she joins the State of Things now. Hello, Kim.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. We talk about attitudes toward marriage, and we're going to kind of get to some of those. But right now, who is getting married and who isn't?
Well, we've been tracking marriage trends and looked at them over the past several decades, and it's definitely on a downward trajectory. So overall, only about half of American adults are married today, and there are big skews, as you alluded to, along racial and socioeconomic lines. So for college graduates, while the marriage rate has come down over the past several decades, marriage is still the norm. But if you look at folks without a college education and maybe with just a high school degree, they're much less likely to get married than they were in the past. And so there's been a wider gap developing there along educational lines. And you see a similar pattern along racial lines. So 50 years ago, blacks and whites were equally likely to marry. And nowadays, it's much less common for blacks to marry. And whites, less so than in the past, but again, there's been a significant widening of that gap.
Well, let's see if we'll talk a little bit about what might be happening and some of the reasons for that, but I also want to look at another trend, when people are deciding to get married. Are they waiting longer?
They are waiting longer, absolutely. The median age of first marriage is now 27 for women and 29 for men. And if you look back to 1960, it was 20 for women and 23 for men. So, and that goes along with, changes in the role of women and educational attainment for both men and women. So people are just taking their time. More are getting higher education. Women have more opportunities and abilities to support themselves. So, don't have to marry as early as they did a generation or two ago. So delayed marriage is a part of it. So at any given time now, you have fewer adults who are married because they're marrying later. But when we look at the share of adults who have never been married, and we did a report on this last summer, that's at an all-time high. And we see looking forward that, this generation of young adults who many people refer to as millennials, a big chunk of them may never marry based on the behaviors of the groups of young adults that have come before them. So that could be a significant change going forward.
And even then, there's a kind of an interesting demographic split, because while the number of people who have never been married is growing, the number is even greater among men than women. Am I right?
It is, yes. And that came out in the report that we did last summer. So there's about 23% of men ages 25 and older have never been married, compared to 17% of women in that age group. And in the past, so we went all the way back to 1960, there wasn't really a significant gender gap. So there's been an opening up there. And one of the interesting things that we found in that analysis was we asked people, unmarried people, what they were looking for in a potential spouse. And we found that young unmarried women place much more importance on finding a spouse with a steady job. And for young unmarried men, that's not as big of a priority. So we know that young unmarried women prioritize a spouse with a steady job. But then if you look at the trends in employment over time, you can see that for young men, labor force participation has gone down. And for those who are working, wages have gone down. So it's made for, sort of a less attractive pool of potential mates for young women. And that may also be contributing to the fact that many of them are delaying marriage or not marrying at all. And when you look at the advances that women have made in educational attainment and their ability to provide for themselves, some are just opting to, go it on their own. And nowadays, raising a family as a single parent has become much more acceptable, and a lot of people are doing that. So they're just kind of, you know, different sorts of family arrangements that are rising up in the, you know, as we see the kind of traditional family fading a little bit into the background.
That raises questions about why people are getting married. And very briefly, you did ask Americans ask people about their attitudes towards marriage. Can you give us a brief summary of that?
We did, and we had one question that was just sort of it got it broadly how people see the benefit of marriage for society, and we found that the public is really pretty divided over the role that marriage plays in society. So we asked people, we gave them two statements, and we asked them which comes closer to your view. The first one is society is better off if people make marriage and having children a priority, and the second one is society is just as well off if people have priorities other than marriage and children. And 46% of the public chose that first statement, so saying that society is better off if people make marriage a priority, and 50% chose the second statement. And unfortunately, we don't have a trend on that question. But a few years ago, we asked another question, where we did have a trend from 1978, and we asked people whether they agreed or disagreed with the statement that the institution of marriage is becoming obsolete, and we had 4 in 10 saying that they agreed with that statement. Right. And at the time, that was sort of, you know, one of the big takeaway findings from that survey. And the question had been asked in 1978, and I think at that time only about 3 in 10 had, or fewer, had agreed with that statement.
All right, we're talking about
another. Oh, go ahead.
Talking about the future of marriage today on The State of Things. There's more ahead. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about the changing institution of marriage. When it comes to who is getting married, there is a clear shift in age, race, and education status. But Americans' ambivalence about marriage also suggests that the institution doesn't hold the same status that it used to. Comedian Aziz Ansari gives us a fresh look at this age-old institution.
Imagine if marriage didn't exist, and you're a guy, and you ask a woman to get married. Imagine what that conversation would be like. You'd be like, hey, so, you know, we've been hanging out together all the time, spend a lot of time together and everything. Yeah, I know. I want to keep doing that till you're dead. What? I want to keep hanging out with you till one of us dies. Put this ring on your finger so people know we have an arrangement. Who's that guy? It's a priest. I want you to swear to God you won't back out of this deal. What's he wheeling in? It's a cake with 2 tiny dolls that look like us. Eat a slice. Now beat a little bit to me. And this is really strange. Why are we doing this? Tax purposes.
All right. Well, why else are we doing this, or why aren't we doing this? We're going to try to answer some of that, those questions today on our program. Joining me now is Christina Gibson Davis. She's a professor of public policy at Duke University's Sanford School. She studies marriage and how it relates to social class. Welcome back, Christina. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, Linda Dixon. She's a sociology professor at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. She studies marriage and the state of marriage in communities of color. Welcome to you, Linda.
Thank you so much.
And also with us, Reverend Nancy Petty. She is senior pastor at Pullen Memorial Baptist Church in Raleigh. Welcome back, Reverend Petty. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
So, Christina, let me start with you. Based on your research, when we think of the word marriage today, sort of how do people see it? How is it defined?
Well, I think it actually still has a lot of meaning to people. So if you say to somebody, he's my husband, they know exactly what you mean. As opposed to if you say, I live with this person, it's not really the same thing. So I think actually the meaning of marriage is very, very clear. What has changed is how people view those meanings and whether or not they think it makes sense for them.
And how are some of those, based on your research, mm-hmm. how is that changing or is it?
Well, we actually think that in some ways, marriage is becoming more important as a symbol. So the reasons people used to get married 50 years ago was because women couldn't survive on their own economically. It was hard to get birth control unless you were married. You certainly couldn't have a child out of wedlock unless you faced a lot of social stigma. And so there were a lot of instrumental reasons, if you will, as to why people needed to get married. Today, those reasons no longer exist. You can have a child, you can live in a romantic relationship with somebody, you can have sex, etc. So we don't really need to get married in the same way. But what we actually think is that people now view marriage as sort of an ultimate status symbol, that their expectations that when you get married, you have a certain amount of money, that you've met the partner who fulfills all of your wildest dreams, and that relationship is never going to end. And because it can be hard to sort of find someone who meets both your economic and emotional fantasies of what a married partner does, you put it off because there's no need to, and so you keep searching until you find that person. And for some people, that person just never comes.
The really hard part is finding somebody who looks like the doll on the cake.
Yes, exactly.
To me, that search goes forever.
Right.
Linda Dixon, what's happening when it comes to marriage in communities of color?
Well, I think especially for African-American communities, marriage has taken a backseat for many years. This plummeting of marriage began far further back than, but it's certainly becoming the norm for other races of people. The major issue I see for especially African-American families, and that distinguishes them from, say, Asian-American and Hispanic families, is the unequal sex ratio is so pronounced, and that has a detrimental impact, not just on marriage among African-Americans, but the quality of marriage for those who do marry. And I have to add that, the unique thing about, another unique thing, I think, about the African-American community is this retreat from marriage is both for both men and women. And yet for women, because there are so many more females, especially employed black females, than there are males, the marriage retreat is more pronounced for this race and gender category.
You were talking about the distortion in the figures, or
yes.
Between male and female. What are you talking about? What do you mean?
Yes, that, well, the recent 1.5 million missing black men, that sort of gave us a sense of where they are. They're either not alive or in prison or et cetera. But I think actually this unequal sex ratio in the African-American community would be more, it would be less influential if the rate of outmarriage for African-American women was higher, but it isn't. And that seems to contribute to the low marriage rate for black women.
Reverend Patty, do you think marriage is becoming less revered as an institution?
I would say yes. And I would say one of the reasons that it is, particularly from the church's standpoint, is We have refused to talk authentically about what marriage means, what it's about, why we should get married. We've tried to hold on to a tradition of thinking within the church. The institution of the church is all about preserving traditions, but this is one place where that has really been a liability for us, in the sense of we want to say that the biblical perspective offers this one view of marriage, when in actuality it doesn't. There are numerous understandings of marriage in the biblical text. And so I think particularly with this younger generation, they're not interested in conversations, spiritual, faith-wise or otherwise, that don't feel authentic to them. And so part of our issue with the conversation around marriage is trying to get real with the conversation about what does it mean, and how do we preserve the best pieces of what it means to make a covenant with another person, to be in relationship with someone, versus what it means just to try to hold up or prop up some tradition that no longer people see as valuable in their lives. And so how do we speak authentically about marriage?
Well, and just from the church's point of view now, looking at marriage as a religious institution, or as it relates to religion, it seems that religions are in a bind in a way. I mean, religions are bound to their traditions, and it's about holding to values and customs over and against the social trends and changes. So how do you speak with that authentic voice and not be, you know, sort of just bending to the winds?
Right. If the church can't figure out a way to translate or interpret our traditions as being relevant for society today, then we're in real trouble. And the church is in real trouble. We, as the statistics show, that marriage, fewer and fewer people are getting married, fewer and fewer people are attending church. And so until we can figure out how to take those traditions in their best sense and make them relevant for people's lives today. And what that means is that the way we think about marriage is going to have to change in order to have an honest conversation about it. We have to look at how people are feeling about it, what they think about it, but also say, this is why, as the church, we think intentional commitments and intentional, authentic covenant-making and promise-making is the best thing for us as human beings.
And yet, Christina, what you're finding is that those ideals that Reverend Petty was talking mm-hmm. about, this idea of commitment and covenant, mm-hmm. Seems to be less important. The idea of status symbol, and I want to ask you more about that, mm-hmm. Marriage as status symbol, are these ideas that Reverend Petty talks about as important? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be a status symbol? Why would marriage be how is marriage a status symbol?
Right, and here's where I think we get into some of the class differences that we see across marriage. And so what the literature shows very clearly is that it's people with more education who are continuing to get married, and it's really those with lower levels of education who are not getting married. Most of my research is focused on people with lower levels of education, and what we find among that group is that marriage is very highly valued, but they don't feel like they can get married because, as your first guest alluded to, a lot of men don't have jobs, there's a lot of people in jail, and so there just isn't anyone for them to marry. But it sort of remains this elusive goal, this thing that they see higher and upper middle class people doing, and so it's sort of viewed as an entree into the middle class. That being said, they don't do it because there are these things that they think they need to have in place, but just aren't there. And if I could just want to add one other thing, one of the big changes is that it doesn't stop them from having children, right? So one of the concerns, particularly among the African-American community, is that the high rate of out-of-wedlock births. So Black women aren't marrying, but they're continuing to have kids. And that raises the issue then of why this separation between why do I not find a husband, but why do I go ahead and find a father?
Well, Linda Dixon, let me ask you about that, but also about class differences in communities of color when it comes to attitudes on marriage. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I was going to add, it's so striking to me that especially among college-educated African-American women, the awareness of that stigma of having children out of wedlock is so powerful that they are often so determined not to want to be associated with the single mom that for many of them they're really caught in a bind, because whereas white middle class single women are more agentic in their decision after so much time. If they haven't found the right partner, they might decide to have a child. African American college-educated women feel more pressure not to have children. Now, the end result, as I'll agree with the second speaker, the end result, they do end up having children, but they have fewer children than they would normally want, and it's not in the context that they would want to have it. This is for middle-class African-American women.
As I listen to the conversation, and particularly Christina's remarks about what we know about who is getting married, more educated, middle class, it does raise the issue of marriage becoming more of this symbol of privilege. And again, the alienation of other groups of people as we see something like marriage becoming a privilege status symbol. And so I think that marriage equality, this is where I think that conversation really comes into play here, is that we have to talk about that this is a right, and R-I-G-H-T, and a right, R-I-T-E, that is available to all people. And that it's not just reserved for a privileged class of people. And so I would be interested to have more conversation about that.
And I think marriage equality plays into it in another way. One of the things we know is that getting married is actually a really good way to get wealth. When married people earn more money, they can invest in houses. We know that married men make more. You actually get a marriage bonus if you're married in the workforce. And so one of the ways that marriage equality may also play out is it results in economic inequality. Because if the only people who are getting married are those who are the well-educated and presumably already have a lot of economic advantages, then the economic advantages associated with marriage are only accruing to them already. And it can be another way that marriage may actually divide, result in higher levels of economic inequality.
But it also points to the inequality built into the system. Linda Dixon, if your research is correct, then what we're saying is that the norm is for white women less stigma about being a single parent if you're white. That's a norm that is built into the system and is already freighted and works against whole African-American community. So it's not about gaining equality. It's about overturning a privilege that we never think about.
Yes, that's true. That's true. And the thing that I'm very concerned about is the very class of people within the African-American community who may replicate the middle-class community. If they are the ones who are deciding, no, I can't do this, then, and the only people who are having children are the working and lower classes, then that is going to contribute to the narrowing of the black middle class.
Can you tell, Linda Dixon, if there is among, say, less well-educated and less wealthy African-American women that marriage is a value, but for the reasons that you laid out, just too much more difficult to obtain?
Oh, I believe definitely the book Promises I Can Keep about low-income women, talking about how important that is. It is such a goal that they strive for. That is certainly the case for working class and middle class African-American women. And again, I want to emphasize the point that for Hispanic women, where the unequal sex ratio does not exist, in fact, there are slightly more Hispanic men than there are women, and for white women, where the unequal sex ratio is not so powerful, it really does the decision not to marry, to wait until the right person comes along. That is more of a sense of choice. For African American women, it just doesn't strike me as much of a choice. And that's troubling.
Kim Parker at Pew Research, let me ask you about what you found when you asked people what they're looking for in a romantic partner. What did you find there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned a little bit earlier that we asked people what qualities they would think would be very important to them in choosing a spouse or partner. And overall, the most important thing that both men and women mention is finding someone who has similar ideas about having and raising children. So that remains a very important value. The next most important thing was finding a spouse with a steady job. And again, there we found a big gender gap, with women placing a much higher priority on that quality than men do. About a third of our unmarried respondents said that finding someone with the same moral and religious beliefs as you is very important to them in choosing a spouse. And about, 28% said someone with as much education. That was kind of surprising. I had thought that might be higher, but...
You said 28%?
Yeah, 28%. And then we also, one of the other, the final quality we asked about was finding someone with the same racial or ethnic background as you. And relatively few said that that was very important, only 7% of men and 10% of women. And the research that we've been doing on interracial and interethnic marriage shows that that's been rising steadily in recent decades. And in 2013, about 1 in 8 new marriages were between people of different races. And that's, you know, an all-time high as far as since they've been collecting that kind of data.
So it gives us some sense of what people say they're looking for. Reverend Petty, when you counsel couples, what do you say, you know, contributes to a successful marriage? How do you counsel people about who to look for?
Right. I think the sharing similar values, being able to communicate those values, and having some similarities in terms of background is really important for people. And those are the kinds of things that I talk about with people that I counsel who are getting married. It's we take a lot of time trying to understand their family origins and what they are bringing into this relationship in terms of their expectations or their presuppositions about marriage. And then we try to really focus on what they're looking for together. And, you know, I still think that in my counseling with people who are getting married, the critical thing is that you have two people who can talk to one another, who can really have conversation about what they hold valuable together and where their differences are, because the differences are real. They're there. They're in any relationship. And so to be able to give voice to those things is very significant.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about the future of marriage. It's a conversation that will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the future of marriage. My guests are Kim Parker, a director of social trends research at Pew Research Center. Christina Gibson Davis is a public policy professor at Duke University. Linda Dixon is a sociology professor at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. And the Reverend Nancy Petty, a senior pastor at Poland Memorial Baptist Church. Also openly gay, and you have had relationships, and you have been both in a committed relationship and a marriage. And maybe that can shine some light on the importance of marriage and how that term and institution do make a difference, at least did to you.
Right. It is ironic that we're having this conversation about the changing role of marriage and it becoming less significant or important in society, as my congregation, along with many others in North Carolina and myself, have fought so hard for marriage equality and for the right to marry. And so I was in a relationship for 13 years in which I was not afforded the right in North Carolina to be legally married. And it placed tremendous hardship on that relationship as a couple trying to raise two children, one biological child of my then partner and an adopted child, just trying to make sure that we were legally covered if something happened to our children, that we both could take care of them. We could both visit them in the hospital because we didn't have legal rights that marriage affords to people when you are married and you can, you know, visit in the hospital, stay in the hospital with your partner and your children, your spouse. And so it placed a significant burden on the relationship. And sadly, that 13-year relationship ended in divorce. And tragic. Divorce is just tragic. It really is hard on everyone. But since then, I have been in a relationship for these past 4 or 5 years in which we were, my partner and I now, were legally married on May 3rd, just less than 2 months ago. And it has made a significant difference in the way that that I think I'm seen as a pastor, as a person in society, that I am legally married in this relationship. And I can tell you from personal experience that you feel different. You feel different when the society that you live in legalizes your relationship, recognizes, legitimizes your relationship. And so, you know, if we are going to talk about marriage and have marriage in our society, then it's critical, it's vital for that, for there to be marriage equality. If we're going to talk about marriage, then we have to say this is a right under our Constitution that's afforded to everyone in the 14th Amendment, and that then we talk about it as a right that everybody has. Because I can tell you that when you are trying to be in a relationship and you don't have that legitimacy, when you're particularly when you're trying to raise a family and you have children, it places a burden on the relationship that people don't have when they have those rights. And so I think that's important for us to remember in this conversation, that if we're going to talk about the role of marriage and the role marriage plays in our society, then we have to really think about what it means for everyone to have that opportunity.
Well, Christina Gibson Davis, it's interesting to hear that, the importance that it, that because it is an institution, mm-hmm. as you say, it becomes a status symbol and everything else, mm-hmm. but because of all the pressures, mm-hmm. and you can talk about how this plays a role in the decision to have children mm-hmm. but not get married, mm-hmm. and how economic status plays a big part in this decision.
Right. So there. So just as there are huge class differences in who gets married, there are even bigger class differences in who has kids out of wedlock. And so what we find when we talk to low-income moms, you know, why did you decide to have a kid out of wedlock, and sort of why was this guy not sort of husband material? They have very clear ideas of what a husband is supposed to be. And a lot of time, those kinds of guys just aren't around. But they're afraid. They also need meaning in their lives, and having kids is a wonderfully fulfilling experience. So they often have kids, even if they're never intending to have a long-term union with the father, because they're looking for someone who can play that husband role. And the husband role really, and the wife role really still resonates as something that is identifiable and means something.
And Kim Parker, it's just interesting to hear all of this in the context of that one question that you put on your last survey about the importance of marriage to the fabric of you know, social structure. Less than half of Americans thought it was. You have no, as you say, comparative data. What did you make of that, and were you able to sort of tease out any more context from the answer that you got?
Well, we did see big generational differences on that question, with younger adults being much less likely to see the value in marriage for society than older adults. And if you look back at previous generations when they were young, large majorities of young baby boomers were married between the ages of 18 and 32, half of them were married, whereas only 26% of millennials are married at that age. So there's definitely a generational component, and that deep divide in opinion isn't seen across all generations. So it's important to point that out. We also asked people, you know, if they thought it was important for a couple to marry if they plan to spend their lives together. And people do still say that that's important. So we had 68% saying that if a couple's going to spend their life together, it's important for them to marry. So it's a little bit of a contradiction, but, you know, people put less emphasis on the importance of marriage for society and how society is going to function going forward. But in terms of individual couples, they think that there really is some meaning to that commitment. And interestingly, if I can just say one thing about the sort of black-white divide on marriage, even though we know that blacks are less likely than whites to marry these days, they're actually much more likely than whites to say that it's very important for a couple to marry if they plan to spend their lives together. So 58% of blacks say it's very important, compared to 44% of whites.
Right. And that actually tracks on to what we know about class differences, because unfortunately in this country, race and class are often correlated. So mm-hmm. that could also be reflecting that difference as well.
Linda Dixon, what have you found on that?
Well, I would like to say, I found myself thinking, especially in the last few minutes, about singlehood. You know, I think it is true that marriage as an institution fulfilled important functions for the society as a whole. We still have evidence that children do benefit from two married parents living under the same roof. There's no question about that. But I think that it may be a good idea to start looking at the options, singlehood being one of them, and providing supports for those who either by choice or by necessity will live their lives as singles. There's growing support for that life choice, and for those who are single parents. So it's about the society embracing broader options in addition to marriage. But I do believe that regardless of the race or the class, that marriage is still going to be something that is highly valued. But at least there should be other options.
Christina?
And support for those.
Right. So just to point out, one of the ways in which America is very different than, say, Western Europe is how bad it is to live outside of a marriage for a child. So in the United States, as the previous guest indicated, there are these very big differences between kids who are raised with unmarried parents versus kids who are raised in married parents. You don't see as great a discrepancy in other countries between single and unmarried couples. And in part, the theory is that those countries do more to support sort of children, regardless of family structure, whereas we are less concerned with family structure and less concerned with sort of providing supports to families. And then that the way our social safety net operates, it doesn't sort of compensate in some way in the ways that some other Western European countries do.
But that leads to a kind of thought experiment, given all that you've said. So much of the pressure around this has to do with the status of marriage as a legal institution. It is a thing. It carries with it a lot of benefits and legal restrictions and responsibilities. So the thought experiment is, suppose there never was marriage. Is the question, what's best for children and social order? Mm-hmm. Does that mean commitment? Does that mean two people together for a long period of time, mm-hmm. a stable household? What if there were no legal at all requirements, nothing called marriage?
Right. I mean, it's a really interesting question. We don't mm-hmm. obviously don't know the answer to that. What we know is that it's important in this conversation to realize that people are still falling in love. People are still forming unions. They're not just getting married. But what we know is that when you form a union but you don't marry, those relationships are much less stable. They're more highly conflictual. You know, as you get premarital counseling, you don't get pre-cohabitating counseling. And there's a reason for that. And so if there were no marriage, relationships would look very different. Marriage is also very hard to get out of, right? It's very hard to get a divorce legally. There's all kinds of issues. And so there's sort of a marriage brings with it its sort of its own momentum, if you will. And if that institution wasn't around, my guess is that the relationships would be a lot more unstable, a lot more churning between partners.
Maybe not. Well, maybe because you're comparing yourself over and against the thing that is the legal thing.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, so people who choose to go that route, you know, again, correlation is not causation.
Sure.
Who chooses to get married and who
sure.
chooses not to? All those things are questions. If it had never existed, it is an open question. But I take your point. Reverend Petty?
I love Christina's idea of cohabitation counseling. I think that's a brilliant, imaginative, and innovative idea, and I'm willing to do that for those who would like to see that. I do think, our kind of dualistic thinking in this society, in Western society, says either it's marriage or it's not marriage. And I think that hurts us. And I have the opportunity every Tuesday night to sit with a group of millennials in my church. We have Bible study every Tuesday night. And sitting with them and talking about these kinds of issues and other important issues, one of the things that I so value in their thinking is that they're a little bit outside of this kind of dualistic thinking. They're able to hold differences and tensions together without saying it has to be one or the other. It's either black or white. And I think the more that we can think about marriage and the various options, as one of our guests keeps talking about, the options of how we live in relationship with one another, I do think we are created at a basic human level to be in relationship with one another and to be in close relationship with one another. And so I think if we could hold all of these things together and say that, which is already real, marriage means different things to different people, and that's okay. Why can we not say that's okay, and let's work as a society and as churches at supporting people in their understanding and how they want to construct their relationship, their intimate relationship with another human being. For some, that may mean getting legally married. For others, it may not. But yet, how do we get out of this either-or kind of thinking about marriage and say that marriage is evolving? It has been from the very beginning of time, and marriage is still evolving. And how can we look at authentic covenants, commitments, relationships that can hold us even when we change and grow and become more whole people? And so that's, for me, when I think about the voice of the church and where I would like for the conversation to go into society, it's more this kind of making room for people to really define what works for them and blessing that, whatever that looks like, so that we can be healthy people in relationship.
Well, Linda Dixon, Reverend Petty talks about meeting with millennials, and I'm wondering if there is a generational divide or you see differences in communities of color over these questions.
Well, it sure seems that there's a lot more reluctance. I mean, and I think one of the things we have to add, I don't even think this is true of just communities of color, but the lack of role models for positive marital or other types of relationships. It seems that every year in my sociology of family class, I give them a survey the first day of class, you know, just sort of their ideals of whether they'd like to be married or would they like to have the kind of relationship their parents have. That's the one I think about because so many, over the years, so many people say no, that's not what they're looking for. So they don't seem to have a model of what it means to have, not just to be married, but to be stably, positively married. I think that's where that book, Is Marriage for White People, comes from, that younger African Americans and Hispanics who haven't seen in their communities, they haven't seen married couples, they don't have models of what that might look like.
Well, I'm wondering, Reverend Petty, when you talk about sort of opening and broadening our ideas, how do you do that with, again, not falling into the sort of relativist, whatever works for you? Mm-hmm. There, because you bring up the idea of covenant. There is some agreement here, a mm-hmm. promise that we're going to hold to.
Right. And I think that's where the conversation begins. It's not that anything just goes, that's not what I hear the millennials saying at all. I want to keep coming back to this notion, though, that we build authentic relationships because I think it's only authentic relationships that can stand the test of time, that can make it through the difficult moments that any relationship's going to have in a marriage. And so if we can work at talking about, okay, what are the basics? What's the foundation? These things are not negotiable in this. I remember a mentor of mine said to me one time in conversation about marriage that he had been married to his wife three times. I mean, he had been married three times, and I said, "Well, you've only been married to your wife, the only wife you have." And he said, "Yes, but on three different occasions, we've had to renegotiate our contract with one another." So how do we do that? How do we say we're in this to stay, not to get out, but how can we make it such that we can grow and learn?
The future of marriage. Our conversation today, the Reverend Nancy Petty, senior pastor at Pullen Memorial Baptist Church. Linda Dixon is a professor of sociology at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Christina Gibson Davis, a professor of public policy at Duke Sanford School. And Kim Parker, director of social trends research at the Pew Research Center. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.